I am pumped about today's show. This is a topic I think about a lot personally, and our guest is kind of a rock star in this field. We're going to be talking today about everyday exposures in our environment. We may not even know when we're being exposed, but they can impact our fertility and chances of a successful pregnancy. We'll be talking with Dr. Tracy Woodruff. She is a professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco, and she is the director of the Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment. She is truly one of the top experts in the world in this topic, and like I said, I am very excited to be talking with her. Thank you so much, Dr. Woodruff, for being here today to talk with us. This is a topic, it's so important, so thank you.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here to talk with your audience.
I'll tell you, not to give you, as my mother would say, not to give you the big head, but we were interviewing an expert on talking about medications and things like that. Ooh. And beforehand, we were I was telling him what we were going to be covering, and a couple of things that I had included in for us to cover were chemical exposures. And he goes, no, I tell you what, he goes, you really don't want to talk to me. You want to talk to Dr. Tracy Woodruff about this. And this guy is he was no slacker in the field. And I laughed and I said, oh, well, it just so happens that she's been on the show. We have interviewed her before and we will. So anyway, yeah. So you have a reputation.
Oh, good. That's good to hear that it's a good reputation because,
Yeah, exactly. It's always nice to know.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So I want to talk today about the impact on fertility and both male and female, not necessarily in the order of female and male fertility, as well as on pregnancy. So I thought the way we would organize this interview would be to talk about in groups of things that we are exposed to in and out of everyday lives. And what is it in that group that the research shows might impact our fertility? So that's kind of the basic format. So let's start with foods. As someone who attempts to eat somewhat organically, but gets frustrated at it, quite frankly. So what are what do we know about the foods we eat that can impact, let's start with, let's say, fertility, and then let's move in and talk about what it might do with our pregnancies.
Sure. So I think that, let's talk about food in general. So there's the food you eat, right, the actual food that you put into your mouth, but there's also all the containers that the food comes in, and both of them are important factors to think about when you're looking at your potential exposure to environmental or industrial pollutants that can be in your food. And so just to back up a little bit from the food topic and just talk about chemicals in general, there are many chemicals that are used in a variety of different processes that are part of our everyday lives. So we're talking about food. That's a good example is in terms of just in the production of food, there is pesticides used in and around food. Food is also packaged food goes through a process where it's processed in a certain particular way. Think of milk, right? Goes through plastic and tubing, et cetera, to get processed into milk cartons. Think about canning and what's going on with that, or storing food in different types of plastic or other types of containers. And so the trip from the field or the animal to your mouth can come along with many different opportunities for exposures to different chemicals. So just to give some perspective on chemicals themselves, we know right now in the United States, there's thousands of chemicals that are registered for use in the United States and thousands of pesticides that are registered for use in the United States. It's about 40,000 chemicals and several thousand pesticides. And we know that people are exposed to these chemicals multiple chemicals, and many of them can come from food. So an example I'm going to give are phthalates. Phthalates are a chemical that are a class of chemicals that are plasticizers. So that's one of the uses, which means that they can make hard plastic soft. They also have been used, which we'll talk about in, I think, the other part of the interview, which is in various types of consumer products, because they can be used to convey scents. But let's talk about phthalates and why they're important. and how you can be exposed to them in food. So phthalates are a part of a group of chemicals called endocrine disrupting chemicals or hormone disrupting chemicals. And what that means is that these chemicals can interfere with the hormone levels in your body. So for example, phthalates, certain members of the phthalate family have been shown to interfere with testosterone levels in the body, particularly when those exposures occur during developmental periods like during pregnancy and in the fetus. And what that means is that phthalates can interfere with the production of testosterone. So if you get exposed to phthalates, the testosterone levels can go down. And since we're talking about infertility, obviously testosterone is both key in terms of male reproductive development so that you have a fully functioning male reproductive system, and it could interfere with the functioning of that system as an adult. So
let me make sure I'm understanding. All right. So what you're saying is I think we'll be talking a lot about different types of endocrine disrupting chemicals, right, and phthalates being one of them. But if a woman is carrying a male fetus or a male baby in her uterus during pregnancy, and she is exposed beyond a certain amount or whatever, I guess we'll talk about that, what the tolerance level would be or the exposure level. And then it could impact the testosterone in her body, which thus impacts her male fetus.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, so because obviously the fetus will not be producing sperm for many years, but it could impact his ability in the future to have a healthy reproductive system.
Right. So during pregnancy, there's a surge of testosterone that happens, which is the prelude to basically the formation of the male reproductive system. So all the different parts start to drop down. And if you interfere with that, you can get high levels of phthalates, which we've seen in animal studies, can lead to obvious birth defects. So cryptorchidism or hyplospadia, so undescended testicles or incomplete formation of the penis, which we do see sometimes in males at birth. But even lower levels of phthalates can lead to more subtle feminization of the male fetus, and that we may not see till they are older those effects on their ability to produce high quality or volume sperm. So,
are we seeing an increase in these type of I don't know if we call them disorders? Are we seeing an increase because we know that our exposure, I don't know if it's continuing to increase, but one would guess that if, in fact, it's having these impacts, we would see babies being born with more feminized features or undescended testicles or whatever malformations of the reproductive tract.
Right. Well, I think one of the reasons people have became very interested in phthalates is because one thing that we are seeing is a decrease in sperm quality that is being observed globally. And some of these studies that were done very early, like in the 1990s, there were studies showing that in different countries, there was a decrease over time in sperm quality. So sperm viability, sperm volume. And a very important study that was published maybe about a year and a half ago, they looked at all the studies that have been done worldwide to look at trends in sperm quality. And what they found is that over the past 20 to 30 years, there's been a 50% reduction in overall sperm quality globally. So that is because that has occurred in a relatively short time frame. That can't really be because of genetic changes. There has to be something going on in the environment that's influencing that. And one of the things that people have been concerned about is the role of industrial chemicals. And this particular one, phthalates, is of high importance because of its ability to disrupt the endocrine system, because it can influence testosterone levels, and because we've seen an increase in the production of industrial chemicals, both in the United States and worldwide, it leads to being concerned about this chemical. Animal studies have shown that some of these phthalates can disrupt testosterone synthesis, meaning making of the testosterone. And some of them have, a few of them have been banned both in states like California, but also nationally. But they could still be used globally, and they're often replaced with other phthalates. And the challenge that we have just in the way we address this on a by the government or in public policy is that we don't necessarily have, we don't have in the United States complete testing on all these chemicals because it's not required by law. So then you could be replacing it with a chemical that is like its cousin. So because it has the same features that you have in the chemical, but it could also have the same health effects. So that's what we're concerned about. And I think the thing that's super interesting, I know we talked a while ago about phthalates, that when you were asking about food, because I'll talk about pesticide in a minute, but the thing that's interesting about phthalates is what we've seen from studies that we've participated in with other collaborators at other universities is that you can have higher exposure to phthalates by eating more food that's basically prepared outside the home. So fast food, processed food, that can contribute to increased exposures to phthalates. And it's not completely clear all the various pathways that may be happening. The reason I mentioned the milk production is because someone had done a study and finding some higher levels of phthalates in milk, and they basically went back to try and figure out what was going on, and they determined that it was possibly from the tubing, like when they're milking the cow and then they have it go through tubing into the milk, that even that amount of contact could increase the level of phthalates in that product. So I think
fascinating.
Yeah, so I think the bottom line on this is that eating processed food also has other adverse health consequences, right? I think that's one of the links to the obesity epidemic and diabetes. So bottom line message is eating more food prepared inside the home, fresh fruits and vegetables, lower on the food chain, can help reduce your exposure to something like phthalates. And there has been some studies to indicate that. So that's just on the, and there are probably other industrial chemicals in food that we haven't even really begun to grapple with. One of the other ones that we've seen some emerging research on is these perfluorinated chemicals. Their links to fertility are not quite as clear, but they're a chemical that we know can influence other types of adverse health outcomes, like it's been linked to cancer, effects on thyroid hormones. And again, these are often in food packaging. So trying to minimize the amount of food that you get with that comes in packaged food is a good way to try and reduce your exposures to some of these chemicals that are being used in food packaging. So that's...
Wait a minute. Before we move, I want to find out a little more about perfluorinated chemicals. But before we move off of phthalates, let me ask, where would people... You mentioned that they were used... They're a plasticizer. They're used in the creation of plastics. And they're used to make plastics harder, generally speaking. And so...
I'm sorry.
Plastic
is out hard, and then you need to make it flexible. So they add the phthalates to make it flexible.
All right. So, and they're not banned and they're not included in the, and so you wouldn't know, there's no way to know. Is there a way, if you're using plastics, is there a way to tell whether they would be by the feel or by the look to know whether they would have higher rates of phthalates in them?
Yeah, it's not clear that they're in the plastics that are. So let me just say, one of the things that's very challenging and also frustrating to deal with these chemicals in these types, in whatever the materials are, that can contribute to our exposures, our personal exposures, is that there's, again, this gets back to how the laws are set up, at least in the United States. There's not a requirement to disclose where all these different chemicals are being used in all these different ways. So what ends up happening is scientists and sometimes the government and public health groups end up being kind of like mini detectives trying to trace all this stuff down. So my understanding is phthalates are not highly used in plastics. People think that maybe the exposures are coming somewhere along the food preparation chain. It is true that the primary source to some of these phthalates is from food, but I think we still have a lot to learn about exactly where it's happening. I will say that the other thing I wanted to just point out is that you're right, phthalates are not banned universally. They're banned in children's toys products, but we've seen a decrease in the use in certain types of phthalates just because of public attention and government scrutiny on their use in certain types of products.
So there's not something that we can recommend for patients, for infertility patients to
actually
avoid.
I think in general, avoiding fast food, processed food, takeout food, fresh fruits and vegetables. And this is a win-win anyway, right, for your patients, because you want, in general, you want to have a healthy diet is important for your health.
Sure,
so
yeah.
Eating lower on the food chain, eating fresh fruits and vegetables, food prepared in the home, that is likely to reduce your exposure to these various industrial chemicals and also, you know, improve your resiliency to other types of health outcomes.
Perfect. Now let's talk a little bit about perfluoridated, the chemicals, and where do you find those? And let me say that's perfluorinated for people who are how I'm saying it too quickly. And I guess it sometimes goes by the acronym PFCs, but anyway.
PFCs, PFAs, perfluoroalkyl substances.
So where do we find those things? What, first of all, I mean, just in our everyday world, most of us have not heard about them. So they're an industrial chemical, I would assume. So how would we know about them?
Yeah. So people may
find them rather.
Yeah. So some people may know about them by their more popular name, which is Teflon. So these are the Teflon. This is in the Teflon family of chemicals. So these are chemicals that were originally developed to be part of your non-stick stain-resistant chemicals. The more popular ones are PFOA or PFOS, but there's a whole family of these perfluorinated chemicals. They're found in many different types of applications. So as I mentioned, they're your non-stick or your stain chemicals that are used for stain resistance. So they're used in fabrics, they're used in Teflon pans, so all the non-stick. They have been used in non-stick cookware. They've been used in fabric, stain-resistant fabrics, non-stick fabrics. They have been used in a lot of other applications that we might not have thought of. So, for example, I've seen one study where they talked about how it was used in a certain type of dental floss. So you can be exposed to these.
Yeah.
So, again, the laws in the United States, you could use these chemicals wherever you want without EPA really addressing them. I mean, they have a new process, but it doesn't require that all these industries say, where are we using it? And we've tested it completely for safety before we use it in these things that people might, for example, put in their mouth. So I think this is an area where we want patients to be as knowledgeable and as active as they can about making sure they make the, you know, they have the power to make the best choices for their health. But there is also a part of this that's you can't and you shouldn't be expected to do all that yourself. You really need to have the government step up and do its job to make sure that these industries are not using chemicals that could harm you or your ability to get pregnant.
So, and on these chemicals, the PFCs and Teflon and others, do they affect females and males? Are they the same kind of an endocrine disrupting chemical? So they affect both men and women?
So they have been linked to changes in thyroid hormone levels, and so thyroid hormones again. So thyroid hormones are part of the endocrine system. Thyroid hormones are important for normal homeostasis. A lot of science has been focused on thyroid hormones as important for brain development during the fetal period, but it could influence a woman's ability to get pregnant as well. I think there's not quite as much research in the fertility area around perfluorinated chemicals. There's been a lot of work around if you're exposed to these chemicals and will that affect the health of the future baby. So there's been work around that. So two of the chemicals have been phased out of use in the United States, PFOA and PFOS, but there are other chemicals that have replaced them. But the challenge with this chemical, which is true for other chemicals that are like this, is that people refer to this as the forever chemical because once it it has this chemical property that once it gets out, it doesn't break down and it persists and it tends to, people can tend to be exposed to it continuously. And once they're exposed, it doesn't go away from their body. It takes a long time to be released from their body. So I think that it's great that PFOA and PFOS have been phased out of use in the United States. But the problem is now is that because it hangs around for a very long time, there's still more opportunities for exposure. So there's been a lot of interest recently because these perfluorinated chemicals are showing up in drinking water supplies in many areas of the United States and at levels that are of potential health concern. So this is why people are concerned about this particular group of chemicals. And also, there are other perfluorinated chemicals that are still on the market, and it's unclear what their potential for health effects are. But some of them look very similar to PFOA and PFOS, so it's likely that they will have some type of health concerns. But, you know, this is an area where there's a lot of active science going on.
Well, that's good to know, actually. All right. So, but we can be exposed through our foods. And another thing that we can obviously be exposed to in our foods are pesticides.
Yes.
So let's talk about some of the pesticides. And you know what? I also want to talk, we can talk about for here in the U.S., but I also think it's important to talk about pesticides used in other countries, because quite frankly, I mean, if you go to the store and you're looking at the fresh fruits and vegetables, you have to look, but the vast majority, when you see asparagus in the summer, it is not being grown, you know, where the temperatures are 80 degrees. You're getting it somewhere else. And the same with, you know, blueberries in the winter or, you know, whatever. We're getting produce from all over the world. So let's talk about the pesticides we're exposed to here in the U.S. when we do have regulations. But what do we need to look for in food we're buying from other countries?
Yes. So pesticides, as you know, pesticides include things that are designed to kill pests, things that are designed to include like rodenticides, rodents, rats, mice, things that are designed to kill weeds, herbicides. And they're all designed to be active on those organisms, right? Pests, weeds, rodents. So they're, of course, already have inherently some type of health concern because of the way that they're designed. So you can be exposed to pesticides through the food in your diet, as you have mentioned, and that it could be because it's used here in the United States, or it can come in from other international places and have pesticides in it. So I wanted to say also that sometimes we can be exposed to chemicals in the food from pesticides mm-hmm. that have been used a long time ago. So, for example, in the United States, arsenical pesticides had been widely used in certain fields like cotton, and then those crops were phased out and replaced with something like rice. And so you can be exposed to arsenic in rice, even though they may not have sprayed arsenic on the rice, but because the arsenic is already in the ground and the rice is very efficient at absorbing arsenic. So mm-hmm. it becomes a historical problem that can come back and revisit us. So I just want to say something about that is really interesting or great about the science on pesticides is that there's been actually a lot of studies showing that if you eat an organic diet, you can reduce your exposure to certain types of pesticides. For example, organophosphate pesticides. And there actually was also a systematic review, meaning they did a evaluation of the literature in a systematic way and to understand what the breadth of the literature said. And they concluded that if you eat an organic diet, you can reduce your exposure to some pesticides. So there is eating an organic diet does reduce your exposure to certain types of pesticides. I mean, your question about food coming in from other countries, I think that's a good question. I think it's a little more tricky because, I mean, I think I'm not that familiar with how the law works in terms of food coming from internet, from other countries. I assume that there's probably some kind of regulation around that, but some of it depends on enforcement. And you know, the federal agency that enforces that has to do some type of monitoring on that food. And, you know, it's fine if you catch it, but that, you know, the monitoring is not probably up to scale of the amount of food that's coming in. So it's
all right. Here's the $64 million question that everyone who is trying to eat organic wonder, or even not just organic, does washing your fruits and vegetables really help?
Oh my God. You know, that is so interesting that you ask, because I mean, in general, I've seen studies that say, yes, that's a good idea, but I've also just seen some recent stuff saying it probably doesn't help. I will tell you something that is helpful is that Environmental Working Group does a very nice guide, because some people don't want to buy everything organic, which is fair. And they recommend the top 12 things to buy organic and the top 12 things that don't really matter if you buy organic. And in general, the way it parses is because, actually, I can talk about this, but generally the way it parses is that things that you can peel, like a banana or an avocado, generally that you can, you probably won't get too much pesticide exposure if you buy that. And that things that are more systemic, like strawberries, peaches, those type of things, better to buy organic. I will say, though, when I raise this issue about arsenic in rice, and it is true, you can get exposures to arsenic from rice can be relatively high. You can actually reduce the arsenic exposures by washing the rice very thoroughly until the water is clear, and that will reduce your exposures by, I've seen anywhere from 30 to 60%, something like that. So I wash my rice. So,
well, you know, and actually in Asian cooking, they always tell you to wash your rice anyway. I have read that, and I'm wondering if you have seen this as well, that actually the arsenic levels tend to be higher in brown rice, which took me completely by surprise. I don't know why. I guess because I always, I had shifted to brown rice because I thought we were getting more, you know, more fiber. But have you read any studies on that?
Yes, I have seen studies on that. I know it's, this is one of the challenges. It's like, oh, I think people hadn't used that. Yes. Well, it turns out that the hull surrounds the white part is extremely efficient in picking up arsenic. I think not as much as other ones, but apparently arsenic loves the hull of the rice, and that's where it goes, right into that hull. So when you eat brown rice, you're basically eating the hull. When you take the hull off, it reduces the amount of arsenic in the rice. Now, I mean, it is true also that the levels of arsenic in the rice vary depending on where it comes from. So places that have naturally occurring arsenic in their water where they grow rice, that's an issue. And then places like the South, and then actually in a few places in California where they used arsenical pesticides on like cotton crops and then they've converted it to rice, you can also get high levels of arsenic. So I think it's, yeah, that is a dilemma. I mean, in this case, though, of course, if you're eating and don't eat mono foods, right? Eat a variety of foods. And I mean, rice probably, you know, there are cultures who that is an important part of their diet. And it's important to eat that along with other fruits and vegetables that are also important.
All right. So any other, before we move off of foods, any other, let's talk about the containers. Is that truly the containers that we store our food in?
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, how big of a deal is that? I mean, there's such a movement now for everybody shifting to, and has been for a while, everybody shifting to glass. And assuming we all know, or hopefully everybody knows, that you should not heat plastic containers. So assuming that you're not heating your food in a microwave or stove or whatever, on with a plastic container, does it really matter if your food is just sitting in a plastic container, or should we all be switching to our very you know, Brooklyn-ish glass containers?
Yeah, so I guess I look at this as a matter of degrees. So, like you said, not microwaving in plastic, good practice. I think that why is that? And let's say, you know, we aren't necessarily sure what's in the plastic. Studies are, you know, may not be a lot of that, but it's just a precautionary approach because things basically heating up plastic, things start to migrate and they can migrate into your food. So from that kind of standpoint, trying to keep hot food out of plastics is probably good practice. The other thing that that chemicals love to stick to are fats, fatty food. Actually, I saw a really fascinating study once where people were looking at oil in the kitchen, like, you know, if your stove is kind of dirty with oil, and they were comparing that to a spot that didn't have any oil, and they were looking at phthalates, and the phthalates just loved being in those oil spots. It's like,
oh man, they're going to go crazy on my stove.
Don't eat off those oil spots. Yeah.
Okay, safe bet. I won't be eating off the oil spots. Okay.
But it was so interesting because, I mean, you don't think of like what we call in science as a sink, meaning that they like absorb these chemicals. But it is true. There's a lot of chemicals that love fat. So if you think that there's chemicals in your plastic, which we know that chemicals are, I mean, plastic containers are made with plasticizers, and you put fatty food into them, they could migrate into that food. How much is it? I don't, you know, this is like, I'm not saying this has been settled or anything like that, but I just, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, it's good practice to be as thoughtful as you can, given all the constraints that you have. And if you want to move to glass, great. But I myself have plastic containers because, you know, it's what you often get in the store and I use them for certain types of things. And over time, I tend to replace them when I can, but I'm not, going out and throwing everything away. I think what this does speak to, though, just on the plastic, I mean, we're talking about the issues about plastics and health. I mean, but there is a whole tie-in with plastics and ecological health in terms of the growth of single-use plastics and essentially petroleum-related products. And it is good just when you're trying to be aware of the amount of plastics in your life, trying to think about reducing it, because single-use plastics do end up somewhere. They don't really go away, and they're not really, really recycled completely, or not, some of them are not recycled at all. So it's in general just good practice anyway for the environment to try and move away from them where you can. I wanted to say something else about the plastics. What you were saying. Oh, the other thing is, you know, that one of the other chemicals, which we haven't talked about too much, but also is actually has gotten a lot of attention because of exposure to it through food, is BPA. BPA is a chemical that is used to make has been used to make polycarbonate plastic. So it's in a lot of hard plastics. We've seen a lot of phase out of this over time because of the attention about its health effects. But it's also been used in the lining of canned foods. So,
yeah,
you know, that's another thing that we recommend. And again, it's really hard because you go to the grocery store and you're trying to buy whatever, 30 things, and you have to like think about every single thing. So just a general rule of thumb, we recommend, you know, you buy your either buy fresh fruits and vegetables or buy them frozen. It's probably an easier way to address this than trying to sort out cans. So there are a lot of canned goods now that are BPA free, though I have to say I'm not completely sure what's in their lining. But anyway,
it's hard to find. It truly is, because it's truly hard to, and it's hard to know when you're buying them. The one product that's hard to buy frozen are fresh, but even in the winter, they taste lousy, and that's tomatoes. So, you know, if you're cooking and you want to, you know, use in the winter using canned tomatoes, and it's really, it's hard to find them that don't have linings in the cans.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and like a lot of these types of, again, trying to make holistically or whole choices that reduce your exposures and increase your resiliency. So if you're eating fresh fruits and vegetables, that's going to put you on the healthier track. And then you can helpfully mitigate some of the effects of some of these exposures. I mean, we know that is true for some types, like a lead exposure. Some of the effects can be mitigated by having a higher quality diet, more iron content. So it's just, you want to be, I think this is why we come back to, this puts a lot of burden on us and the consumer to try and figure this all out. So wouldn't it be a lot better, and actually seems appropriate, that the people who are putting the burden on us should have to figure out about not whether these chemicals are toxic before they go into products, and then eliminating mm-hmm. those that are. So that's why we keep coming back to it, you know, making sure that the government is doing its job to ensure that the mm-hmm. that we don't have to be exposed to things that aren't going to that are going to harm our health.
And let me say, for those people who are listening, we are very aware that this can feel overwhelming. It can also make you paranoid that, you know, just existing, you are exposed to, it feels like you're exposed to things that can impact your fertility. And when you're pregnant, everything it feels like is a potential assault on your baby. However, at the end, we're going to try to summarize and give you a few things to take away, a few tips to take away that will hopefully simplify this. But we want to keep going into detail now, and then we will try to bring it around and simplify things. All right. So we've talked about food and food containers and chemicals that can come in through the growing of the food, as well as pesticides, herbicides, rodenticides, and things such as that. Let me pause for a moment to say this show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. For women who have been undergoing fertility treatment and are still struggling to conceive, Ferring wants you to know about the Ferticalm app. It is designed specifically to help women address the many challenging emotional life situations that arise just naturally coming up when you're struggling to conceive. You can get more information at FertaCalmApp.com. Now let's talk about our beauty products. Mm-hmm. At least arguably we have more control over that. Perhaps not, but let's talk about first of all, what are the chemicals of greatest concern, and how do we avoid them?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Some of the chemicals that we are concerned about in food are also some of the chemicals we're concerned about in beauty products, which phthalates, though some of them have been taken out of the product chain more efficiently than others, but phthalates are a group of chemicals. They're used in the scent that you often smell with beauty products. There can be chemicals that are things that are known carcinogens, like formaldehyde, that have been found in some beauty products. You can have other types of volatile organic compounds, basically compounds that are can have a variety of different types of health effects. I think it's there's parabens, which are used in a lot of beauty products, and there's some concern for those chemicals because they appear to influence the hormone system. So the thing that's interesting or great about beauty products is you can actually look on the back of your anything that you buy. They have to list all the ingredients they're using in those products. So you can't actually see everything they're using. I admit, I look at them, and many of them, I scratch my head. So that's kind of one of the challenges, is that a lot of these things that we use are like, what is this? And has it really been tested? Maybe not. So I think some rules mm-hmm. of thumb, the thing that you were said about beauty products is that we can, you know, decrease the number or decide to use different ones. So there is some control over that. There is a lot of activity going on to try and make, again, or through the policy process, to have those that are toxic chemicals in them eliminated. So some things that are important is to try and choose the products that are fragrance-free. I think that one of the things that is a challenge is that you can get a lot of different types of chemicals. So the thing is, a lot of products come with this thing that says, whatever, it's listed, perfume, fragrance, whatever. But the way the law works in the United States is everything that's put under that category is a, quote, trade secret. And so we don't actually know what chemicals are used in there. So there can be many, many different types of chemicals that are used in there. Phthalates is one of the ones that we know is used as in that category. And some of those chemicals could be toxic. So choosing things that are fragrance free is pretty easy. And then you can also reduce your exposure to whatever they're putting in there. There's a great guide that's put together by the Safe Cosmetics Group, which basically ranks products in terms of what we know about the toxicity of the different chemicals that are in there, and also gives you some information about if there's chemicals used in that product that we don't have a lot of data on to understand its health effects. So that's another way to also kind of make more smart consumer choices. It's, I will say, having gone through this process myself, it's overwhelming at first to try and sort through everything. But I think with a little bit of investment, you can kind of figure out the products that work for you and then just continue to kind of focus on remaining in that product category. Take less showers, I guess. I don't know. My husband,
wash your hair less.
My husband went shampoo free and it worked for him. So I don't know. You know, different people have different things they're doing. But I, in general, try and choose. I think less is more in this situation, right? So try and choose products that have less ingredients, less fragrance, mm-hmm. you know, have been vetted by these public health groups that are working to try and figure out what's in them, I think will help. You can also start to minimize some of your exposures in that area.
Have you heard of the app Think Dirty?
No, I'm going to look it up right now.
It is. It's a great app. I think I am not an expert on it at all, but I believe it's free. And you use the app to read the barcode of whatever the
beauty
is. And it pops up and it will tell you. I was looking, I had downloaded it and I was getting ready to buy some lipstick.
Yes.
And I checked it out with the barcode and I went, oh my, and this was like two or three months ago. And I think it gave me a rating, which told me that I should not be buying it. It had a lot of fragrance, had a lot of stuff. I throw that out there as a,
as
something.
That's great. The other one I know of is Skin Deep. That's the other one, that also does the same thing.
Okay.
Skin Deep, which is done by the Safer Cosmetics, group. Oh, this is interesting. I didn't know about this. This is great.
And I think there's an app called The Good Guide, that also talks about the giving you good information about the chemicals mm-hmm. in a product.
Mm-hmm.
I've never used that one, so I don't speak. And honestly, I've not used Think Dirty very often either.
Well, they're partnering with Breast Cancer Fund and the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, so that's good. I mean, I think those groups are all kind of collaborating together to try and create options for you to look at it. I mean, the other thing that's been amazing, just even over the last 10 to 15 years, is there's more companies who are selling personal care products that don't have the chemicals that have been identified as toxic. Mm-hmm. And there's lines that are in. I mean, some of them are in these more kind of holistic pharmacies or, you know, but Whole Foods. But you do see that just a little bit of searching on the internet, you can find beauty care lines that are selling toxic-free mm-hmm. products. So,
yeah. And honestly, you can do it on, if you're buying from Amazon, you can just type in paraben-free, less toxic, unscented, and then read reviews. I don't know how good that is as far as, I mean, how accurate the reviews are. But I have done that as well. So another things that those are things that we can do and that can at least give us ideas on how to get fewer chemicals.
Say one more thing about this?
Sure. Absolutely.
The way that language is used for labeling is very important because some things are regulated and some language is not. So for example, organic is you have to meet a certain type of definition that's put out by USDA in order to be an organic product, but you don't to be a natural product. So in terms of these personal care products, which will also come up with this, the cleaning products and also is this term fragrance-free versus unscented. And I know.
What is the difference? I didn't know. I thought they were the same.
I know, right? So a fragrance-free means that the product does not contain fragrance chemicals. So, but unscented means that they can put other chemicals in it to hide a scent. So that actually is a very interesting difference. So I, so
I had no idea.
So unscented means there's no odor, but that could be because other chemicals are put in to mask the whatever scent it had. So I guess the bottom line for me is I'm going to be choosing fragrance free.
You know, the I think when I have, thinking particularly of shampoos, I probably have been using unscented, not knowing the distinction. But next time I buy, I will look for fragrance free.
Yeah, I know. See, we learn something every day in this job.
Yes, we do. Sometimes more than we want. So now moving on to cleaning products. You know, they seem harsh, and so it does seem, I mean, many of them do. But it does seem like the ones that have more stuff in them clean better. So let's talk about what chemicals that we know of that can impact fertility or can impact pregnancy in our cleaning products. And let's say both household as well as, clothes washing, if there's a distinction.
Right. So, okay, so in terms of cleaning products, so right there is what you wash your clothes in, but also the cleaning products that you use in your home. So the issue with chemicals being put in to either create a scent or to mask a scent, so those in itself, so the smell can be potentially contained toxic chemicals. And then there are other types of things that are used in cleaning products that may be toxic, and I think it's similar things that we're concerned about in our food and other types of areas also can be a problem. So I think one of the things that we've been kind of interested in is that we are seeing some of these chemicals, which actually we don't really know a lot about, but are highly used. There's a group of chemical called QACs, Q-A-Cs, which are quaternion amines, which I actually even still have a hard time pronouncing. But they've been shown in some animal studies to actually be reproductive toxicants, and they're used in some cleaning products, but we really don't have a good understanding about the potential for exposures and fully their health effects. I would say also things that end in oxide, like those types of things can also be toxic. I think that one of the things...
What are they in? What about the oxide chemical? What are they in?
Well, yeah, so here I'm like, this is going to be a little bit out of my total issue area, but I think that varies on the different type of cleaning products. I guess what we have just do in general is that we say is you can use cleaning products that are non-toxic and don't cost any money. So things like vinegar and baking soda are fine products to use for cleaning.
Okay. So and so baking soda and vinegar actually are effective at cleaning, doing the cleaning that we need.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and a lot of the antibacterial fetish that we seem to be in as a nation has been really shown not to be good for our health, for one, in general, also not necessary.
Right. And I will say, right. So there has been a lot of, right. So there's like those hand sanitizers that have triclosan in them. I mean, that actually the FDA is looking at that because triclosan doesn't seem to be effective in terms of course, triclosan is one of those chemicals that used in many different things. But triclosan is also, it's an antibacterial. So it kills a lot of the bacteria, which is a challenge because you want to actually don't want to kill all the bacteria because that leads to antibacterial resistance. But also it's been found to disrupt thyroid hormones. So that is one that's can be found. I think it's been, I have to say though, that FDA is, I think, put it either evaluating it or said that they're recommending it not be used in hand sanitizers and soaps because it's also not been found to be effective.
Well, in general, if you could avoid buying any cleaning products that have antibacterial properties, but it's sometimes hard because it's a marketing tool. So,
right.
Yeah, it's not always easy because I make a real point of it, and it's sometimes hard.
Right. But I think, again, things like phthalates are also found in some of these scented cleaning products. So that's a problem. Sometimes you see things. I think some cleaning products may be very specific, like spot removers or carpet and carpet upholstery. So that could have things like perchloroethylene in it, which is used sometimes in dry cleaning. But then mm-hmm. quaternary ammonium compounds, which I mentioned, which are quats, which are can be found in, like I said, cleaning products. Can be labeled as antibacterial, actually can be found in fabric softeners. I'm concerned about them because I've seen some studies suggesting they could be important for reproductive health risks. And then there are some things that, you know, for example, ammonia and chlorine, you really don't want to be exposed to a lot of that because it can be a respiratory irritant. I don't know, not sure what the studies are about infertility, but they could lead to other types of health effects.
You mentioned dry cleaning, and I wanted to bring that up. Should we avoid dry cleaning let's talk about it from a fertility standpoint, a pregnancy standpoint, and then a general health. Because when you pick up something from the dry cleaners, there is definitely the smell is still there.
So perchloroethylene has been one of the solvents that's been used in dry cleaning. It's a possible carcinogen. It's a neurotoxic, meaning it can affect brain. It's probably developmental neurotoxin. If something affects the brain, it probably affects the developing nervous system. But generally, a chemical that has those types of health effects probably has some influence on reproductive health. I have to say I'm not as familiar with its reproductive health effects. And perchloroethylene, though, has been looking to phase out in some states. I think California has been looking at that. I do think that in general, there are other methods to dry clean your clothes that I have seen articles on that don't involve solvents. So I think that's a good option. I personally choose to try and clean as many of my clothes on the gentle cycle in the wash or hand wash without trying to go to the dry cleaners. I know it's tricky because some clothes ask dry clean only, but I do think reducing that helps. There were definitely studies back, you know, from maybe the 80s and 90s showing that you could, when you picked up your clothes from the dry cleaners, there could be significant off-gassing of some of these chemicals from the dry cleaners. And a lot of dry cleaners have been switching out some of it for air pollution reasons. So I think you have to check locally about what's going on. And you can choose now green cleaners, though it's important to make sure they're not using other types of chemicals, but are actually using processes that are, you know, basically chemical free.
Mm-hmm. And you'll find that I have found that very often I can wash things on a gentle cycle. So far, I haven't ruined anything, but your mileage may vary, let's be honest.
Yeah, that is true.
This show and everything and a lot of the other resources that we do here at Creating a Family could not and would not happen without the generous support of our partners. And these are clinics that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. One such partner is Fairfax Cryobank. They are a U.S.-based leading source for sperm and one of the largest selections of sperm and donor sperm products and storage solutions. They have 6 sites across the U.S., and they provide a large and diverse selection of donors. And you can get more information about them at their website. All right, so we've talked about cleaning products. We've talked about general household products. Is there anything else that we've left out that you think of that we need to be aware of before we try to summarize and bring things down to a doable level. So we have up to this point overwhelmed everyone. Uh-huh. So what we would like to do at the end is kind of, if possible, simplify. So what are some of the top tips that you tell people who are either trying to conceive or know that in the future they will want to conceive or they're pregnant? What are some things that they can do that they can actually implement and not go around being afraid of actually just living in this world?
Right. So some of the things that I tell people, mostly what I focus on are the things that I also try to do that are simple and cheap and also available. So one of them is eat fresh fruits and vegetables, lower on the food chain, and to eat a diet that is essentially more from food that I prepare in my own home, that I buy at the store and I prepare in my own home. That's and there's a lot of resources available about ways to make cooking a more simple process. The other thing I also recommend is where you can to buy organic, again, because it's available and much more available than it used to be, and it's accessible at the store, and there are resources that you can use, like the Environmental Working Group top 12 mm-hmm. things to buy organic, so you can pretty much figure that out. Don't spray or use pesticides in the home or even outside the home. There's resources that show you ways to mitigate the pests coming into your home or less toxic alternatives. Another one I want to say is also pretty easy to implement and can help is to take your shoes off and to wash your hands before meals. So that's because a lot of chemicals are in dust. So they may be originally in your products, but they migrate out and then they get in the dust and then you're exposed to the dust. So taking your shoes off outside the home, washing your hands before you eat, and using a wet mop are all ways to reduce and to have been shown in some cases to be effective to reduce your exposures. And then when you're buying things, choose things that are fragrance-free. Don't buy things with scents in them because those will have chemicals. And try and reduce your use of plastics where you can. So on our website, which I think we might have sent to you, which is, or if you just put it in your search engine, Program on Reproductive Health in the Environment, UCSF, Toxic Matters. We have a series of brochures that people can download, and it links to other information about easy tips that you can use to reduce your exposure to toxic chemicals or other types of industrial chemicals that we may not yet know that are toxic in your everyday life.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tracy Woodruff. This has been fascinating. And it's also really important because when you're trying to conceive, and especially if it's not happening as soon as you want it to, we want to take control. We want to be able to do something. And this is something that people can actually do.
Yes. And the other thing I really want to say to people is do not blame themselves for this, because I know it feels like we should have control over this, but some of this we don't have control, and we should. The government that we do control is supposed to be doing this job of making sure that anything that's sold on the marketplace comes to the marketplace with chemicals that have been tested and are not, so that we know that they're safe for the use and our exposures. So I encourage people to be engaged personally on this issue, but also actively letting the government know. And everyone should vote. So that's my other recommendation.
Okay, thank you. The views expressed in the show are those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the positions of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. Thank you so much, and we will see you next week.